This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a hearty Beth Jacob welcome to any first-time visitors here tonight. I'm very excited to be able to introduce Rabbi David Lappin tonight. A number of years ago, I was, as many of you were, among over 100 people who showed up week after week for a number of years at the Doubletree Hotel in Santa Monica to hear what was always a fascinating shiur from Rabbi Lappin. As he covered the texts from Nevi'im with his provocative and refreshing approach, what unfolded were his unique views of the thoughts and emotions that drove the characters: anger, greed, jealousy, and much more. Every Torah thought he articulated was relevant, and to many people it was life-changing. Rabbi Lappin is a student of some of the great rabbinical minds of the last generation. His late father, Rabbi Avraham Chaim Lappin Zatzal, was of that generation and had a tremendous influence on me personally. As a teacher, Rabbi David Lappin spearheaded the Baal Tshuva movement in South Africa 30 years ago. Many of his graduates today play leading roles in communal institutions in South Africa and abroad, and many are prominent rabbis of communities and yeshivot. In his business, Rabbi Lappin lectures and teaches corporations how to use ethical imperatives as the basis for good corporate governance. His clients include American Express, Coca-Cola, General Electric, the U.S. Department of Justice, and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in Los Angeles, just to name a few. In South Africa, his clients include most of the financial institutions, as well as mining, retailing, and manufacturing companies. I once remember Rabbi Lappin advising a member of the Pacific Jewish Center congregation who was thinking of running for president not to get involved in shul politics. I remember that piece of advice very well. Some days I wish I had acted upon it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's truly an honor and a great pleasure for me as a Talmud and as a friend to introduce to you this evening one of the most exciting teachers of Torah in the world today, Rabbi David Lappin.
Thank you very much, Martin, and ladies and gentlemen. And Martin, I enjoyed that so much. Will you do it again next week? The story of Yehuda and Tamar is well known to you. Yehuda, one of the, if not the most outstanding son of Yaakov, after the sale of Yosef to the Yishmaelim, goes off to find himself a wife. He gets married. He has a few children. He finds a wife for his oldest son, Er. Er dies. He suggests that the widow marries Onan, which is the first case we have in the Torah of the mitzvah of Yibum, where a man who dies without children leaves a widow who then marries his brother. So the children are established and the family continues. Not a mitzvah that we practice today, but it's a mitzvah of the Torah. He also dies. And Yehuda advises his daughter-in-law to go back home and wait until his youngest son is ready to get married. And Chazal say he did not have any intent to actually marry her off to his youngest son, but he kind of politely and courteously gave her that advice. Eventually, Yehuda's wife also dies, and in order to console himself, distract himself, he becomes single-mindedly involved in business, does very well, and on one of the celebrations shearing his sheep, he encounters a woman who he thinks is a harlot, has a relationship with her, turns out to be his daughter-in-law, and from that relationship comes Mashiach. Odd story. Odd, certainly, because of the fact that this is a relationship that ultimately generates not only King David but Mashiach. But odd even without that. Imagine to yourselves, whoever you wish, the most outstanding rabbinic authority you can think of. Somebody today, somebody contemporary, somebody from years ago. Whether you want to think of one of the great Hasidic Rabbeim, one of the great Rosh Hashivas, the Chofetz Chaim. Think of somebody exceptional. And imagine the story being told about them. Imagine hearing a story like that about the Chofetz Chaim. That he went into celebration, is walking down the street, passes a pretty young girl, and has a relationship with her. It's just totally out of character. It doesn't make any sense at all. And so clearly this part of the Torah requires some kind of deeper understanding. And the only way we can gain that understanding is through the oral law, the written law. The Torah as it's written in this case is completely incomprehensible. And we need the oral law. Sometimes people say, oh, well, you must be able to read it as it is. It's true. But if we didn't have the oral law, would we know what to put inside the box of tefillin? We all wear tefillin, and the tefillin are meticulously manufactured and made and handwritten. How do we know what to write? How do we know what to put in? How do we know how to make it? It's not in the Torah. The Torah says you put on tefillin. It doesn't tell us what tefillin are. We need the oral law. The Torah tells us build a sukkah. Doesn't tell us what a sukkah is. Not even does it not tell us how to build one. It doesn't tell us what it is. It says you shall dwell in sukkahs for 7 days. What is a sukkah? How many walls? What about the schach? Where do we get that from? Torah Shabbat here, from the oral law. Shabbat, what do we know about Shabbat? You mustn't light fires on Shabbos. Is that what Shabbos is about? How do we know what Shabbos is about? The oral law. Laws of damages, financial laws, business laws. Where do we know them from? A few sentences in the Torah. Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral law. So if we want to disregard the oral law, we have nothing. We don't have a religion. Our religion is rooted in the oral law, not in the written law. It's true, the oral law is in turn rooted in the written law. But in the Chumash, in the Torah, there is no comprehensible description of what our religion is. And just as we need the oral law to understand any aspect of our practice, we need the oral law also to understand the stories of the Torah. They don't make sense without the oral law. So we're going to learn this parasha through using some of the Torah Shabbat there. One of the Midrashim, we'll use primarily the Midrashim in this instance. The Midrash sets the scene. What was going on cosmically at that time? What was happening? Look at the world. Says the Midrash. Shevatim, what about the tribes at that time? Shevatim, of course, they weren't tribes yet. They mean the heads of the tribes, the sons of Yaakov, the founders of the Jewish nation. What were they doing at that time? Hayu asukim b'mechiroso shel Yosef. There's a whole tumult going on. The Shvatim, the heads of the tribes, the sons of Yaakov, are planning the sale of Yosef, which leads to Egypt and to Paro and to Pesach and to Sinai and to everything that comes afterwards. That's all beginning to unfold. The germination of the process of going in and out of Egypt is being planned at this time by the brothers. But Yosef, what is Yosef doing? Yosef is one of the royal pillars of the Jewish people. Yosef and Yehuda. Joseph and Judah are the two royal pillars of the Jewish people. Royalty comes from them. Yosef, hayo osuk besakoy v'tanisa. Poor Yosef. He was in mourning. Sitting, fasting, wearing sackcloth, believing that there was no chance that he would ever see his father again. that he would ever see his brothers again, that he would ever be part of the Jewish nation again. That was what he believed. That he was being banished permanently to a foreign land where he was forbidden to have any contact whatever with his own family. So Yosef is osuk b'sakui v'tainisui, in sackcloth and fasting. Reuven, what about Reuven? The oldest of the brothers, what's he doing? He's feeling incredibly responsible and guilty. It was his idea to throw Yosef into the pit, and he was going to come back later on and save Yosef from the pit. He was never a part of the plan to sell Yosef. He was certainly not a part of the plan to kill Yosef. His plan was to save Yosef, but he came to the pit and Yosef was gone. What was he feeling like at that moment? Reuven, he was also in fasting and in mourning and feeling enormous remorse. The Yaakov, what about Father Yaakov? What was he doing? He was sobbing in tears and mourning, having lost his precious son. Look what the family was involved in at that time. And we need to appreciate that when we talk about that family, we're talking about the foundations of history. That their state, their emotional state, does not just describe the state, the emotional state of individual human beings. This describes the emotional state of a whole world of happening, of preparation of events. The Yehuda? What was Yehuda being doing? What was Yehuda doing? So we've got Yaakov's crying, Reuven's crying, the brothers are selling Yosef, Yosef's crying, and Yehuda? He was on the shidduch route. He was looking for a wife. That's what he was doing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And what was God doing when all this was going on? What was on God's mind? What was he busy with? Isn't the Oral Law fantastic? Where do you find such a question? And God, what was he busy doing? HaYosek Borei Oiroi Shel Melech HaMashiach. He was busy designing the energy that would give rise to the house of David and the birth of the Mashiach. That's what he was busy with. All of this event, all linked together towards one pattern, the ultimate coming of Mashiach. We needed to go into Egypt in order for there to be a redemption and in order for there to be Messiah. To get into Egypt, we had to get the family down to Egypt. To get the family down to Egypt, Yosef had to go to Egypt. For Yosef to go to Egypt, the brothers had to sell Yosef. They had to get jealous. The whole thing took place in order to unfold a series of events that on the one hand would lead the Jewish people following Yosef to Egypt, and on the other hand, an unusual relationship between Yehuda and his future daughter-in-law, which starts with him looking for his own wife. So it's as important, these two events taking place simultaneously. The unfolding of the trip down to Egypt, leading to those terrible years of slavery. And Yehuda, which seems to be just a private story, a man looking for a wife. No, this is just as important a part of the unfolding of history. And so Yehuda goes, let's look at some of the verses, Psukim. He meets a man there called Hiro. He also finds a woman there, daughter of a trader, marries her, has a son called Er, another son called Onan, another son called Shelah. Three sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. Vayikach Yehuda isho le'er b'chayro, Shmo Tamar. Yehuda arranges a shidduch now for his oldest son, so this is several years down the line, and he finds Tamar to marry his oldest son, who is Er. Tamar is a very special woman. Apart from the fact that she was clearly unbelievably beautiful, she was also the daughter of Shem. Shem was the son of Noach, and Shem was the Semitic branch of Noach's children, and so she comes from a very important family. Shem was the source of Torah The continuation of Torah right through that period was through shame. Shame, v'eva. These were the people who taught what Torah was known at that time to Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. They studied with these people, and Tamar grew up in the home of shame. So she has a tradition, she has a value system, and she's a very beautiful person. And he takes her for heir. Vayehi Er Bechor Yehuda ra b'inei Hashem. But Er, the Bechor, the firstborn of Yehuda, was bad in the eyes of God. Vayemiteyu Hashem, and Hashem killed him. We're not told what he did. We'll find out what he did. But at this point, we're not told what he did, just that he was bad, and God killed him. It does happen that good parents have bad children. And it does happen that bad parents have good children. And it is true. But as much as we like to think that parenting has a whole lot to do with the quality of the children we raise, sometimes the most absent parents raise the finest children, which leads one to believe that it's not much in our hands. And if we would just leave them alone, they would raise themselves very nicely. And most of the reasons that they have to visit psychologists later on is to undo all the stuff we put into their heads when they were children. Just leave them alone, provide an environment that is healthy, that is safe, that is has a good value system around and about them, and stop interfering with them. Just leave them alone, and they do very well. Or they don't do well, but there's nothing you can do about that either. Yehuda, Yehuda, what finer father could one want than Yehuda? Had a bad son. Can happen. I once asked Rav Meir Soloveitchik, the son of the Buskarov, what's the secret? How do you raise children? What did your father teach you? What did your grandfather teach you? What are the principles? So with a little twinkle in his eye, he says to me, come. Very unusual that he ever goes outside of his house, but he takes me outside of his little apartment and he takes me to the neighbor and he says, put your ear to the door. Well, that didn't feel all that comfortable. He says, no, put your ear to the door. Put my ear to the door. I heard such cursing and swearing you can't imagine. He says, you hear how they speak to each other? I said, firstly, I did, but how did you know they would be cursing and swearing at the very moment that I put my ear to the door? He says, because they're always cursing and swearing. I said, well, what's that got to do with the question? He says, they have children you can't imagine. Rosh Hashivas, Talmidei Chachamim, Tzaddik, you can't imagine. He says, now come here, and he takes me to the window, and he shows me an apartment block across the yard, and he says, and in that apartment, there's a great Rosh Hashiva, and his children are terrible. So you ask me, what's the secret? There isn't a secret. You daven to God, pray to God, because there's not much you can do about it. And we see that it happens in the Torah too. Vayomer Yehuda lo Einon, bo el eshes achicho v'yabei moiso. And now Yehuda's got this magnificent woman, Tamar, who's left as a widow, and childless. And the law of Yibum is here introduced. He tells Onan, you should marry Tamar. V'hakein zera l'achicho, and thereby you will establish seed for your child, for your brother. V'yeda Onan ki lo yihyeh hazora. Onan realized that the children will not be credited to him. That's an interesting discussion which we're not going to go into right now. What does it mean they won't be credited? Of course, he'll raise the children. They will be credited to him, but there's an aspect of it we'll see. V'hoyoim bo el eshes ochiv v'shiches arzo levilteinu sanzera le'ochiv. And so he married Tamar, but made sure that whenever they had relations, there was no possibility of conception. And he wasted seed. V'yera b'enei Hashem asher oso. And God was very angry with what he did. V'yomes gam oso, and killed him too. From that word too, we learn what Er was doing. But that was the same sin. And the reason that Er was doing it was not for quite the same motivation that Onan was doing, but Chazal tell us, because, as Rashi says, Kera'aso shel Onan, Er did the same thing Onan did, Mashchizera, made sure that there was no possibility of conception, because we see that they both died for the same reason. V'lama haya Er Mashchizera, why did he do that? So that she should not become pregnant and damage her beauty. That's why he did it. And that's quite interesting, because there's no suggestion from these psukim that contraception is not allowed according to the Torah. Not at all. And we know quite well that sexual relationships with a woman at a time that she cannot possibly conceive, or during an age that she cannot conceive, or when she's pregnant, is perfectly allowed. So we know that in our religion, more than in any other religion, the physical relationship, the intimate relationship between man and wife, is not just about having children. Children are the outcome. But that's not the purpose. So what's so terrible about what they did? Well, contraception. They didn't want children. What's the big deal? The big deal is that in their relationship to this beautiful woman, all she was an object of sex. And that was bad. That was serious. It was their attitude to Tamar that was unforgivable. It wasn't so much the act of what they did. What was important is the fact that they wouldn't allow her to develop an independent essence of herself, an independent persona as the mother of their children, but used her merely as a token wife in all her beauty, and used her just for their own beautification and pleasure. That was considered a diminishment of the dignity of Tamar, and they were both punished with death for that. That's unacceptable in the Torah, to treat a woman merely as an object of a man's desires and satisfaction. Vayomer Yehuda leTamar katan, so Yehuda now says to Tamar, he doesn't say, well, wait a while and then you'll marry Shelah. He says, why don't you go home? Shvi almono beis avich, go back to your father's house as a widow. Ad yigdal Shelah bini, until Shelah, my son, becomes older, and then you can come back and you can marry him. Says Rashi, doche hoyoiso bekash, he was just pushing her away. Shelo haya bedat lahasi aloi, he had no intention of marrying her off to Shelah. He's lost two already. He's not going to risk a third. And we have a principle in the halacha, in fact, of an isho katlonis. If a woman loses her husband once, she remarries and loses her husband again, two views in the halacha as to whether it has to happen a third time or not, when she's not supposed to remarry, because we assume there's some kind of connection. No husband survives this woman. Best not to be involved in that kind of shidduch, and she should stay on her own and not kill men. And so Yehuda applied that law too. Two men have died. Who knows what's going on? Yehuda doesn't know the background. Yehuda doesn't know the reason, the intimate relationship that was going on between Aaron, Oinon, and Tamar. All he knows is the boys have died. And he assumes for some reason this is just a relationship that isn't meant to work with his family and hers, and she should go somewhere else. She knows that's not true. She knows exactly why her husbands have died. Not because of her, but because of them. So why doesn't she say to Yehuda, Yehuda, don't push me away. I'm not the problem. Your sons were the problem. Why doesn't she say that? She's not willing to in any way undermine them in the eyes of their father. So she goes. That's Tamar. But she's not finished. Eventually, Yehuda's wife dies. And Yehuda, comforts himself. And he goes to shear his sheep. Vayugad leTamar leEmor, it's said to Tamar, your father-in-law is coming to Timnah to shear his sheep. Vatasar bigdal menusah me'aleil, she removes the widow clothes from her. She was dressed as a widow, as they used to dress in those times. Vatechas batseif vatitalaf, and she covered herself with a kerchief, with a kind of a scarf, and according to Unkelus veitkant, and she looked very good. Bateshev Befetach Einayim, and she sat at a place called Petach Einayim, which could be a crossroad, and some say it was a base, a medrash, a shul, and all different interpretations. We'll see some of it. She sat at a certain place, Asher Aderech Timnata, which is on the road to Timnah. Ki Rasa Ki Gadol Shelo, why? Because she knows now Shelo is old enough, V'hilo Nitna Lo Lisha, and he has not been given to her for a husband. You think Tamar couldn't find a man? A woman of that quality and that beauty couldn't find a man? There was only one family she was interested in marrying into, and that was the family of Yehuda. There was nobody else in the world at that time that she had any interest in marrying. And there was Er, there was Oinon, who's left? Shelah. and Shelah is not coming her way, and she realizes why. Nothing she can do about that. But she's not going to give up the quest to marry into Yehuda's family. Vayir'eho Yehuda, and Yehuda saw her, vayakshaveh halazoino, and he thought she must be a harlot. Woman sitting on her own at the crossroads. What's she doing there? Again, what would the Chofetz Chaim do if he's walking down the road and he sees a woman who he thinks is a harlot? What's he going to say? Shalom Aleichem to her. He'll cross the road, walk on the other side of the road, turn around the block and go somewhere else altogether. Why did he think she was a harlot? It says, Ki chisto fonel, because she covered her face. Strange things. Harlots don't usually do that. Vayet eileho el aderech, and he went towards her. He crossed the road towards her. Vayomer, and he said to her, Havona avoy eleich, let's have a relationship. Ki lo yoda ki chalosa, he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Batome matitin li ki tovo eleich, and then she asks for what are you going to give me? I don't just do this. Where's my ring? We're going to just have a relationship. This has to be marriage. I'm not interested in just a relationship. And he says, well, I haven't really got anything right now. And she says, well, give me a security until you do have something. And he gives her his signet ring and his staff, his stick, which is the same stick, by the way, that Moshe uses so many years later to split the sea and do all the miracles that he did.
Literally
the same stick. The same stick. The stick has a long history. Started long before this and goes on for a long time after this. That's the story. The actual event here, if you look at it, the Midrash has an interesting thing to say. Two Midrashim that are going to be rather interesting. The first one. We're told, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bikesh la'avor. Yehuda really wanted to walk right past her. Yehuda did not want to stop, did not want to engage her, and certainly did not want to have an affair with her. V'zimen lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu malach. And God brought an angel, Shehu Memuna al HaTava, the angel who is responsible for passion. Amar lo, and said to him, Yehuda, Heichan atahelech, where are you going, Yehuda? What are you doing? Such an opportunity. Meheichan malachin amdin, where are kings going to come from, if not from this relationship? Meheichan gedolim amdin, where are great people going to come from? Vayete le'a el aderech, and he walked side towards her. Bar kocho shelo betovato, he did it by force, by an urge, by an energy that wasn't from within him and wasn't his choice. What the Midrash says. Now, a few things about that for the gentlemen in the audience. If you ever find yourself in a town walking in areas where you shouldn't be walking, looking at people you shouldn't be looking at, and you find an irresistible urge to get into conversation with one of those women, do not come back and tell your wife that an angel told you to do it, because that won't work. The Torah is not generally shy to tell us when somebody does something wrong and to criticize them. This is not the New Testament. The Old Testament is very blatant about the sins of great people. It understands, great people have flaws. I would like to tell the story of an emerald that I once bought, not knowing anything about emeralds. Just looked beautiful. And brought it back to South Africa at that time and gave it to a jeweler friend of mine to evaluate for us and give a sense of what it was worth. And he put it under his microscope and he started looking at it, and I saw the color of his face change. He went completely pale. And I began to get a little worried. I said, what's wrong? He said, I can't find a flaw. I said, well, that's wonderful. He said, it isn't. If I can't find a flaw, it isn't real. I said, then find a flaw. Which fortunately he did later on, because precious things produced by nature are flawed. If they're not flawed, they're artificial. It's not possible for nature to produce an unflawed object. It's not possible for nature to produce an unflawed human being. And any religion that worships an unflawed human being is worshipping a piece of plastic. It's not real. Can't be. People are flawed. Our flaws are what make us real. Our flaws are what create the tensions and the challenges that make us great. Without them, we're meaningless. And the Torah is quite ready to identify the flaws of great people, to hold them under a microscope, to magnify them, to deal with them, to criticize for them, to hold them accountable for it. How many times do we have that? And there is not one word of suggested criticism in anything Yehuda does in this process. Not a sense that anything might have been improper. On the contrary, we're told this angel came and pushed him. He didn't want it. There are three questions on this matter that we need to deal with. Firstly, how do you know when it's an angel and when it's you? That's just a practical question. It's just a little bit too convenient. Whenever you want to do something delicious, it's a little bit trite. It's an angel. The angel of Tiber is telling you to do it. How do you know when it is and when it isn't? How do we know that that was the case? And secondly, if God wanted it to be this way, why couldn't he do it kosher? Why couldn't he have a nice shidduch that somebody would put the two of them together again? Somebody mentioned to Yehuda, what would happen? Let Yaakov call Yehuda and say, what's happened to Tamar, such a beautiful young lady? And Yehuda would have told him, and Yaakov would have said, you know, Yehuda, if you don't want her for Eir, you marry her. You've just lost your wife. It's also Yibum. Could have been done kosher. And Yehuda could have taken her to shul and had a chuppah and a kiddushin and Yisurin, done it properly. Why did it have to be this funny way? And the thirdly, the most odd thing of all is, okay, it's an angel. And what does the angel say? Yehuda, what about kings? What about great people? Who's going to come out of this relationship? How can you not have a relationship with her? You'll deprive the world of King David, of Mashiach. How can you not have a relationship with her? That's fine that an angel says that, but which angel was it? Hamamune ala taiva, the angel of passion. It wasn't the angel of sanctity, this wasn't the angel of royalty, this wasn't the angel of... It's the angel of passion. Almost like the Yetzer Hara. Why is that the angel that talks to Yehuda? So we have to understand this a little bit. And in so doing, we've got to see here that this was a moment of reversal of what happened at the tree of knowledge with Adam and Chava, with Adam and Eve. The Sipurna says that Vatipakachna Ine Shnehem, when the eyes of the two of them became open after eating from the tree of knowledge, what did their eyes become open to? Explains the Sipurna, for the first time they were able to identify pleasantness, good taste, deliciousness that is not necessarily healthy. Until that time, human intuition was completely attuned to that which was healthy both spiritually and physically. The human being found no pleasure in anything that wasn't virtuous. After eating from the Eitz Hadas, virtue and pleasure were separated. It was possible to have pleasure without virtue, and it was possible to have virtue without pleasure. So there was a separation of pleasure and virtue. That's what happened at the Eitz Hadas. What we see happening at this moment is good and bad, and I'm calling it bad at the moment just for lack of a better word. Tov v'ra, that the good and bad coming together, and bad here meaning the passion and the desire and that force of attractiveness that Yehuda felt for Tamar at that moment. Because what we have here is really the symphonizing of good and bad in an absolutely harmonious crescendo that takes place at that particular instant, giving the energy that gives rise ultimately to the house of the Mashiach. And the concept is dealt with Kabbalistically by the Alshich and others, that even the purest of pure things need something to make them sustainable and worthwhile. There's got to be something material, there's got to be something physical that attaches to them. When something is too spiritual, it isn't sustainable. And the Alshich gives many examples, and we'll have these examples in the series. The same with Tamar and with Boaz and Ruth, we'll see it. We have many examples of it where there is a deliberate introduction of something almost improper to give substance to something very pure. And what we need to do here is understand it's not the introduction of something improper, it's the introduction of something which on its own would be improper. So passion on its own, passion not attached to virtue, can be dishonorable. And where do we see that? We see that with Er Onan. What did Er have? Was he not passionate about Tamar? Er was so passionate about Tamar he didn't want her to become pregnant. He wanted her to stay just as beautiful as she was as a young girl. He was totally obsessed with her beauty. That's passion unattached from virtue. And when a woman loses her sexuality and her femininity and just becomes the matriarch, that's virtue without passion. And what defines the house of David is the re-merging of passion and virtue. Taking somebody very beautiful and very attractive, and taking a man very passionate and very potent, and bringing them together, not in an act of passion, but in an act of virtue. The creation of great people, the creation of the house of David, and the creation ultimately of the Mashiach. So let's look at the process a little bit more clearly, and here we'll do one other medrash which gives just an interesting additional angle to what happened. The medrash learns here where it says Vayero'er Yehuda, that Yehuda saw her, says the medrash, Lo yishgiach, he didn't really pay much attention to her. Kivan shekista paneh. But after he passed her, she covered her face. That was interesting to him. So he walks down the road and she looks at him, and Chazal says she communicates in that look, as only women know how to do. I'm available and married. I'm Jewish and I've been to the mikveh. That's the look he gives her. She gives him. And he kind of notices it but doesn't notice. Walks right on. Thinking to himself, she must be a harlot. How does a strange woman approach a man? Doesn't he recognize her? Doesn't he see this as his daughter-in-law? No, say Chazal, in the house when she stayed with them, and it's part of his family, her face was always covered. He never saw her. That was her level of tsniut, which we'll comment on in a moment. So here he sees this beautiful young girl, notices that she's attracted to him, he walks on, and then she covers her face. And he says to himself, therefore, she's not sitting there waiting for a man. She was sitting there waiting for me, and only me. She has no interest in anybody else. What's this about? That's the moment the angel says to him, what do you mean, what's this about? This is a relationship that's destined to be. This is a woman you've got to be with. And it's then that this irresistible urge comes upon him and he approaches her. The role of the scarf of her covering her face is also interesting. The Medrash says, Shtayim heim shiniskasu b'tzif. There are two women who covered themselves with scarves. Tamar and Rivka. Tamar and Rivka both covered themselves with scarves. Rivka, as soon as she saw her to be husband, Yitzhak, Eliezer brings her home, and as she comes riding on the camel, she sees Yitzhak is davening in the field, and she puts a scarf around her. And this case here with Tamar. Ushtehim yolda tu'umim. And interesting, both of them gave birth to twins. What's a scarf got to do with the twins? Fertility experts would find that a little hard to believe. But there is a relationship, there is a connection between the scarf and the twins. The twins indicate an intense ability to conceive. And what we see here is the essence of tzniut and its meaning and its role in that relationship. Covering your face with a scarf is tzniut because there are two aspects to covering a face with a scarf. The Muslims have got it not altogether wrong. The one aspect of it is tzniut, in the simple sense of the word. You can't see her face. A woman's face is very expressive, as is anybody's face. And with the scarf, you can't see those expressions. So you don't know what she thinks of you, you don't know if she's interested in you, you don't know what you don't know what's going on. Tzniut. But there's another aspect of it as well, which is that it's very alluring. a woman knows how to cover her face with a scarf in the right way, it can be exceptionally alluring. So what is the tznius? In order to attract or in order to cover up? Tznius is a specific form of attraction. Tznius, a woman who is alluringly covered, sends out a message which is, if you want to get to know me, you're going to have to unlayer the layers. You're going to have to get to my essence. That's what it means. You're not going to get to know me by having a look. You'll see nothing. You want to get to know me, you're going to have to discover. You're going to have to journey. You're going to have to adventure. It's going to be a process. That's what tznius means. When a woman exposes her flesh, as women in Los Angeles know how to do, what's that saying? What you see, that's it. I am what you see. No discovery. That's not attraction. It's a different type of attraction. It's an attraction to the surface, and tznius is an attraction to the essence. Tznius does not mean that a woman should make herself look unattractive. Tznius means a woman should make herself look super attractive. That's what it means. Using the alluring power of dress. That's what it means. And what does attraction mean? Attraction is the taking in. Come in. Come into me. Penetrate me. Discover me. Find out who I am. And what is conception? Is it strange that women who excel in tznius have a capacity to, in a supernatural way virtually, create the propensity for conception? And that's what the Medrash is telling us. Two women who use the scarf alluringly and modestly were able to create such an energy of attractiveness that conception came to them so easily that they both had twins. Not coincidental. That was by design. So here we see this woman Tamar using tznius in a way that communicates exactly what she needs to communicate. Yehuda falls for it in an irresistible kind of a way, so to say, pushed to it by the angel of Taiva, by the angel of passion, not the angel of righteousness and saintliness, by the angel of Taiva. That's what Taiva's meant for. That's why God gave man that urge to be attracted to women like Tamar. That's what it's for. Use it, says the angel to Yehuda. And Yehuda does. And from that comes a wonderful lineage. But how do we know? That last question that we have to ask. We ask three questions. The first one is, how do we know? Which we'll answer now. Why couldn't it be kosher? Because God wanted the passion. God wanted the attractiveness. God wanted the merging of good and bad, the merging of physical animalistic passion with the highest form of virtue, to get back to the pre-sin age where pleasure and virtue were separated. Here they come together. And why the angel that was Mamuni al Ataiva? Why the angel of passion? Because that's the angel, that's the urge, that's the drive. Man and a woman coming together is not a matter of intellectual calculation. What happens nowadays with shidduchim, I've got it wrong on both sides. In the secular world, it's about the most external manifestation. So the women, girls, try and present themselves in ways which are not alluring. They're sexy, they're noticeable. But what's the notice? What is noticeable? The surface. Is that a marriage? And in the religious world, it's a mathematical calculation. They sit down and interview each other and go through some kind of cerebral communication about how well-fitting they are for one another. Where's the taiva? Where's the urge? The urge to discover the woman beneath the alluring coverings. Coverings of personality, coverings of being, coverings of mystery. What's happened to those women? What's happened to those men who want those women? And we wonder why the world is filled with singles. The world is filled with singles because women don't know how to be attractive and men don't know how to be attracted. So they sit opposite each other and stare at each other. That's not attraction. That's not marriage. That's not connectedness. And that's what one would hope that they would teach in the girls' yeshivas. That's what one would hope they teach in the boys' yeshivas. But I'm sorry to tell you, they don't. They don't teach it there. They don't teach it in the colleges. They don't teach it in the shuls. They don't teach it in the homes. And we wonder why we've got a singles problem. Why wouldn't we have a singles problem? It's amazing that anybody connects. That's incredible. But the third question, how do you know when it's an angel and how do you know when it's you? What does it mean? How do we know that this was an angel with Yehuda? You can say that an irresistible urge was a divine urge only when you test yourself in situations where there's no urge at all, where you have complete freedom of choice. And that's the second part of the story, which is more important than the first. Because the second part of the story reveals to us how we know that the first part was driven by God and not by Yehuda's own urges. Because Tamar then disappears. She takes his stick and his signet ring and off she goes, and he can never find her again. He wants to then send the gift and invite her home. He wants to marry her. She's nowhere to be found. He sends to go looking for her. He describes her as best he can. Nobody's seen her. Eventually he gets news 3 months later that Tamar, the daughter of Shem, who therefore has the status of a Kohen, has become pregnant out of wedlock, which for the daughter of a Kohen those times, according to those views, is a capital offense. It's a defiling of the status of Kohuna. It's a very serious thing. And they bring her to Yehuda for judgment. He still doesn't recognize her. He knows she's Tamar, and he feels incredibly disappointed in this wonderful girl. The girl that he chose out, the daughter of Shem, he chose for heir. He wanted Onan to marry. He would have given to Shelah if it weren't that he was worried. This magnificent woman. And she's pregnant. Who's she been sleeping with? Where's she been? What's happened to her? And she's brought to judgment before him. And he has to give a judgment. There's only one judgment. The death sentence. And she accepts the judgment. And then she just leans over to him and gives him a package. And says, the father of my baby is the owner of these things. Do with it what you wish. Now look at Yehuda's dilemma. What does he do now? Does he say, I'm the father? Imagine what that would be, Yehuda. Imagine again, it's inconceivable, but just imagine, one of the tzaddikim, Chofetz Chaim, goes through a story like this, nobody knows about it. Happened one night. The Chofetz Chaim was walking on his own and it happened. God pushed him, forced him, anything happened, and this occurred. And a woman gets pregnant. And now he's going to say, it's me? What does that do to his status? What does that do to his reputation? What does that do to his family? How is he going to handle that? Does he let her go to to execution? What a dilemma. What does he do? And what does he say? Vayaker Yehuda. Yehuda immediately recognizes. There's the signet ring. It's clear. She does it secretly. She does it quietly. Nobody need know. He could have ignored it and sent her off, and nobody would have known the difference. And he says, Sodko mimeni. She has been more righteous than I. I promised her to Shelah and didn't give Shelah to her. She did the right thing. I sinned. I was wrong. At that moment, there's a duplication of the sound. There's an echo. He says, these are the words that come out of his mind. Sadko mimeni. She is more righteous than I. But when he says the word mimeni, which means mimeni himu beres, says Rashi, she's pregnant from me. At that same time, yotzeso basko. A heavenly voice came out into the court of law, into the Beis Din, and you heard God say, Mimeni, no, it's from me. Not immaculate conception. Umimiti yotzu advarim. I caused this to happen. That's what I did, says God. This is divine. At what moment does God say that? Only at the time when Yehuda owns up. only at the time when Yehuda takes responsibility and says, I did it. Then God says, this is divine. And if Yehuda wouldn't have owned up, then what? Then it wouldn't have been divine. This is the moment that we can see that Yehuda was brought to this by divine intervention and not by his own selfish interest. This is not a selfish man. This is not a man who's out to satisfy his own instincts and desires. This is a man who's willing to put himself second, and truth and right and correctness and other people first. And from this little piece of Chumash we learn amazing laws which are not kept today. Because we like to sometimes look at ourselves as Orthodox Jews and look at others as Reformed Jews, Conservative Jews, and feel quite self-righteous because they don't keep everything, you know, they pick and choose. Well, you know what? So do we. We also pick and choose. Because we learn from here a law, which is after, it's a halacha, it's paskin, this is a law. The law is, you give your life rather than embarrass somebody in public. If that's the choice, if you can't survive without embarrassing somebody else, then you don't survive. There is no condition under which public humiliation is permitted. We learn that from Tamar. She was prepared to sacrifice her life. She knew she might be executed. She assumed she would be executed. And she could have avoided execution just by saying, excuse me, gentlemen of the Beis Din, I have something to say. The father of the child is sitting up there. That's all she had to say. But that would have embarrassed Yehuda. Rather let me die, she says. We saw that in Tamar right in the beginning. She wouldn't tell Yehuda about Aaron Onan. So Yehuda thought they died because of her. She kept quiet. Because of that she didn't get to marry Shelah. Doesn't matter, because of that she got to marry Yehuda. And it's at this point that God intervenes and says this is divine, because from here we learn that murder doesn't mean necessarily taking all of somebody's life. Taking part of somebody's life is also murder. And when you destroy a person's dignity, you've taken part of their life. And just as you're not permitted to save yourself by killing somebody else, we're not permitted to save ourselves by killing part of somebody else. That's the law. That's the halacha. Why don't we keep it? Because it doesn't suit us to keep it. Like Reformed Jews don't keep Shabbos because it doesn't suit them to keep Shabbos. And we get very sanctimonious about that. We just have different levels of what suits and what doesn't suit. But this is a halacha. This is a law that we learn from Tamar. That Noach lo el adam shi'apil atzmo l'kiv shana esh, as the Gemara says. It is more comfortable for a person to throw himself into a furnace of fire, val yalbim p'nei chaveri b'rabim, rather than to cause a person embarrassment in public. David HaMelech was accosted, King David, we'll learn about him in 2 weeks' time, his relationship with Bathsheba, which hounded him all of his life. And people would come to him in public and would say, David, we've got a shaila, got a question, David. Yes, David would listen. Tell me, David, a man has a relationship with somebody else's wife. What kind of death sentence does he get again? What does it say in the Torah? Just remind us. Over and over they would come at him like that. And David would answer, Misosin Bechenek, you're right, death sentence, strangulation, that's the punishment. But after he's been strangled, he comes upstairs and he goes to Olam Haba, he goes to the world to come. But one who embarrasses another in public, as you've just done, he might not get strangled, but he doesn't get to Olam Haba. That's what David answered. Learned from his grandmother Tamar, but that's the principle that is there. And so on the question of how do you know when a person is driven by an instinct that is truly divine, because we do have instincts that are really manifestations of God's will. We have instincts that are manifestation of animal desire. We have instincts that are manifestations of negative, destructive forces. But we also have instincts that are driven by the finest of forces. How do we know? We know by the way we choose. The way we choose when we have absolute free choice sheds light on the reasons for which we've acted when we act out of instinctive urge. And given absolute free choice, as Yehuda had, when we can say Tzodko Mimeni, she is the righteous one, not I, and we can take that kind of responsibility when nobody would have known any the better had we not, we demonstrate our virtue. And we know that down to the deepest core of our beings, there is only virtue, there is only sanctity, there is only greatness. And it's for that reason that there isn't one word of criticism against Yehuda for that which he did. There didn't need to be criticism. Yehuda criticized himself. And his criticism was not the way he treated Tamara in this instance. He married her and lived very happily with her. His criticism was that he didn't arrange for the marriage to Shelah much earlier on. It's for that reason that we see that Yehuda was driven by these forces of divine intervention to ensure the ultimate coming of Mashiach. Not from a dry, sterile shidduch of a man and a woman who put together because they both come from good families. Nor from a passionate relationship of two individuals who know nothing about one another but are attracted to what they see on the surface. But by a force that harmonized both the deep male force of attraction, the woman's force, the feminine force of alluring tzniut, and the highest sense of virtue of the creation of the house of David and the Mashiach ultimately. Thank you.
Take some questions.
We should take a few minutes of questions.
A few minutes of questions.
If there are any, okay. Take this. Yes.
You mentioned that Yaakov Avinu was standing in the Yehuda did not know where he went. But Yosef was at a very high
That's a very good question, because when the brothers took him out,
the question was, Yehuda, we understand why Yaakov was in tears. He didn't know where Yosef was. Reuben didn't know where Yosef was. Yehuda didn't know where Yosef was. But Yosef knew where his father was. Why didn't he pick up the phone and call him? Is the question. Isn't that right? And the answer was, because when the brothers took him out of the pit, they said, we'll save your life. He would have died in the pit. We'll save your life. We'll sell you to the Ishmaelim. But make an oath that you'll never contact your family. And he respected that oath. That was the condition on which he was saved, and that he respected him. Yes.
Two questions. One is, it's wonderful that you helped clarify the nature of Yehuda, that he was doing the right thing. But I always was struck by the parallel or the opposite of what's going on with Yosef at the same time. Yosef, when having the chance to have Potiphar's wife, sees the face of his father and runs out. And that was almost, to me, showing the opposite of Yehuda, who, you know, without your analysis, looks like he's succumbing. And I always thought that was really to show, look at Yosef and how he dealt with the same kind of situation.
Right. Two very different personalities. That's why Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik, and Yehuda is the Melech. The personality for a tzaddik and the personality for a melech are two different personalities. A melech needs the passion, and he needs the urge, and he needs the drive, and the tzaddik needs the restraint and the ability to say no. And it's the house of Yosef and Yehuda together that form the two foundations. It's almost the same polarity we have right through the Torah, a positive mitzvah and a negative mitzvah. Shamor v'zachor on Shabbos. The active and the passive, the withdrawing, the system of the diastole of the heartbeat. It's just in every form of polarity in the Torah is that outward force and the inward containment. And in the Yosef's case, in his environment, it was right, it was true. She also, Potiphar's wife, also knew that she had to have a child with this man's family. But Yosef knew it didn't have to be with him, and it didn't have to be with him and her. It was with her daughter later on. She didn't know that. But both of them, they happen at much the same time. They, in the Torah, they appear together. There is a duality. There is a parallel between them. And yes, they respond in completely different ways. Yosef the tzaddik says no, and Yehuda the king says yes, and off he goes. And these are two different forces. And we see this pattern right through Yehuda's family, all the way to David. The king that has to go out and conquer people, conquer women, conquer the world. With the force of his personality and his righteousness, very different from Yosef.
Yeah. But
also true. There was no way under those particular circumstances it was right. If Yehuda would have been in that situation, he also wouldn't have had any relationship with Potiphar's wife. But had Yosef been in the situation with Yehuda, with Tamar, he probably wouldn't have noticed her. He might have walked right past her. He was the tzaddik. Let's take the last one. We made tonight that harmonizing of the forces of passion and virtue in one being, we don't see that in any family to the same degree anyway. We see enormous virtue in Tzidkus, and we see passion and wildness, Shimshon. We see many men who did weird things and funny things, but Mashiach didn't come out of those relationships. So in the house of David we see that constant merging of the passion and the virtue, and yes, that brings to sin. You know, when you're playing with passion and virtue, you don't always walk straight. Sometimes something goes wrong. But the way they handle their errors, and that's the point you're making, was key. And Yehuda's very name, Yehuda means acknowledgement, accountability. That's what Yehuda means, to be moedah, to say vidui, to confess. That was key to them all the time. But in that family there was, you're right, an immediate ability to say, I did wrong, and I'm take responsibility for it, and I'll fix it as best I can. And that makes them capable of being kings. We see there probably the most important dimension of leadership is that, the capacity to be moedah, the capacity to confess and to be accountable. Thank you. Okay.